This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 28th of August, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on this week's episode, we head to Madrid to hear how the Spanish capital is undergoing something of a design renaissance.
In terms of design, the most important things I think is that we have very competitive products inside the European market. We have a very Mediterranean character that makes the difference between we and the rest of the European designers.
We step across to Lisbon and pay a visit to a public toilet billed as the sexiest WC on earth.
You can rest, and if you are in a busy day or in Lisbon, you can rest when you come inside. We have lots of place to put things, no problem. Every cabin is cleaned after each utilization.
And I'm joined in the studio by architecture critic Rowan Moore. He'll be talking about his new book, Why We Build.
People are up for being excited by new buildings, but I think there can be a kind of deepening of the understanding would be a good thing. And really, that's what I'm going to do with the book. So without getting kind of heavy and boring, I want people to discover more about what's good about buildings.
More on that in a bit. Elsewhere, we hear from Gale Architects about their new film, Life Between Buildings. And we visit London fashion designers Ely Kishimoto, celebrating their 20th anniversary in the industry. That's all to come over the next hour on Section D. We start this week's show in Madrid, where changing attitudes and regulations are prompting a reinterpretation of the city's once-forgotten rooftop spaces. The capital has been gripped by a colourful renaissance over the last two decades, but as our correspondent Liam Aldous learnt, Madrid's design culture is finally gravitating back towards its more traditional elements. He went on an afternoon tour with German Alvarez Galvez and José Manuel Fernández from architectural and interior design firm Cuarto Interior to discuss why Madrileños are now looking up to the skies for inspiration.
We always say that Madrid is like a big village and Barcelona is like a small city. And if you're comparing that, it's very difficult to compare one to another. Each one of the cities has their own personality. The people that live in Madrid is a very warm city. And for example, in terms of tourism, it's a very interesting place. It's a place where everybody loves to come. It's a very open city. It's very easy to make friends, to hang out. That's the result of that mixture of people coming from everywhere from Spain.
We're sitting at a rooftop bar on top of Cibeles Palace. Once the city's grandiose post office, in 2011 the iconic building was reopened as Madrid's City Hall.
La ciudad ha ido cambiando, yo bajo mi punto de vista, bastante rápido. El problema que tiene un cambio rápido es que...
From my point of view, the city has been changing quite fast. The problem with rapid change is that local bars and shops suddenly began to throw off old and tired designs. And when this love of modern, cutting-edge design began, everything started changing at once. Today, people have started to appreciate what we had before. It's like a dog chasing its own tail. Tastes and trends are revamped, but what we like is also sourced from our roots.
This is a big building compared to what there used to be 100 years ago. When this building was made, it's much bigger. It's a stone, white, yellow stone. Used to be the Casa de Correos, which was the mailing office, the main office for all Spain. It's maybe the principal building of Cibeles. And there is a heart inside, which used to be there's a patio, a big patio, which has recently covered with a huge glass cover. It's like National Gallery in London. There was a space there. Nobody realized that it was a very important space. Now we are using it for doing events, presentations. We have recovered a place that it was totally significant to do something new to for all the people of the city. I think this place has a very important meaning in terms of transformation of the city. We used to have a very small town hall, a very like a village town hall, and recently, after a very, very hard investment, they moved the Ayuntamiento, the town hall, to this building, which is located in the real heart of the city. This means Madrid is also transforming the city into a very bigger city. It used to be a small city in the last centuries. Now we are aiming to be a European capital. So we look for it's to be in the line of cities like Milan or Rome, Paris, and all our neighbors. I think this is the real heart nowadays of the of Madrid.
We leave the shade of the rooftop bar and head to our next location. Along the way, José Manuel is talking to me about the state of Spanish design.
In terms of design, the most important things I think is that we have very competitive products inside the European market, and we have very competitive prices. And on the other hand, we have a very Mediterranean character that makes the difference between we and the rest of the European designers, like from the northern countries or English, French. So I think these are the most important characteristics of Spanish design, which is being very well known in the rest of Europe. For Japan is working very well, even Middle East, where we have also a very good relationship. They love the Spanish traditions and Spanish design. I think tradition is something very, very characteristic also of the Spanish market.
We've just come up the elevator, paid our €3, and come up onto the rooftop terrace of El Circo de Bellas Artes in the center of Madrid. Can you tell me why rooftop terraces are becoming so important in Madrid? They're popping up everywhere.
They're very important because we have just discovered the heaven, the roof of Madrid, because traditionally we have been hiding from the sun. This is a very hot country, so what we've been doing is hiding and having not terrace but living in the interiors. From 10 or 15 years to now, even because of the non-smoking regulations, we have discovered the terraces also down in the street. But I think which is the most important are the terraces on the top of the buildings. And what you can see is that you have a view that you're not used to of Madrid. It's a brand new view of Madrid. It's very interesting.
So do you think, you mentioned the smoking law has forced people outside a bit more and people are now enjoying the sun and the rooftop terraces. Do you think that these laws have changed the design, culture and the way we use space here in the city?
Yeah, absolutely. And business, they are developing new spaces outside. Regulations have been changing, so now it's much easier to do terrace not only during the summer, but also along the year. So this way we are also trying to improve the restaurants and bars in Madrid.
So Germán, obviously when it's announced that they're going to convert this space, an iconic space in the city, into a bar, a lounge bar and a restaurant, there will probably be a bit of a controversy and people might complain about the commercialization of public spaces. What do you think about this?
A ver, siempre que creo que está bien, ¿no?
I think it's fine as long as the commercialization of these spaces means that everyone has access to them. Even if it is in exchange for a small fee, people are still contributing to them. Some of the buildings are in danger of disappearing or being abandoned. Getting a private company to enter into the equation and turn public buildings into a business can be a way of making them profitable and aid in their preservation. If it is a non-profit venture, I see it as positive. However, the profit levels of a private company using a public space is always controversial in Spain. I think that if these benefits contribute to architecture, its preservation or the social good, I don't see a problem. But the controversy begins when companies begin to exploit these public spaces.
This is a familiar theme in the regeneration of the city's cultural icons, and Germán is keen to take me to a thriving example of this marriage between public space and private enterprise.
Let's go to Mercado San Antón.
We climb the stairs, resisting the delicious food stalls along the way, and arrive at our final rooftop terrace for the day, atop the San Antón Market.
So do you think it's changed the city life or the lifestyle of citizens here in Madrid for the better or for the worse?
Sí, yo creo que sí. Absolutamente cambia el estilo de Madrid. Primero porque en este caso.
Yes, I think so. Absolutely. Because in this case, it was a novel idea. Before the market existed, the Mercado de San Miguel, also a public space, was converted into a typical Spanish food market. It wasn't working as a traditional market, and so it was reinterpreted and was a success. Being a success, people are using it, and of course, it improves the city's quality of life. Where we are now, you're right in the city center, and by taking an elevator up to the top floor, you're surrounded by beautiful people, a friendly environment, and modern design, which also maintains cultural aspects of tapas bars in Spain.
Well, it seems the waiter just arrived and he's just serving up our drink, so maybe we should cheers each other and just have a nice refreshing drink on this hot day.
Salud.
Salud, hombre, salud.
Leaving Madrid behind, we return to Midori House to demystify the wonderful world of architecture after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. If they help make a city, you'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Now, books about architecture too often fall into two camps. Either tomes of beautiful photographs that gather dust on coffee tables, otherwise known as architecture porn, or at the other end of the spectrum, there are those with too many long technical words and drawings written by architects for architects. Architecture seemingly is a difficult topic to write a book about if you want to engage anyone beyond the industry. But Rowan Moore, a trained architect, critic, and former director of the Architecture Foundation, has succeeded in writing a book about architecture that is unusually enjoyable and engaging, and not just for architects. It's called Why We Build, and Moore joined me in Studio One earlier.
To be honest, I don't read that many architecture books myself. There are a few gems, but quite often just reading words about architecture is quite tiring and difficult.
And was that something that you set out to actively avoid?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, what interests me in writing for a newspaper about architecture is the possibility of explaining it to people who are not architects, which is not always easy to do, but that's the kind of task I set myself, without dumbing down, without saying stupid things.
No, exactly. And this is also something that I think is a big problem with architecture industry in general, is that on the one hand, you want to try and explain the importance of buildings to daily life and the fact that you don't have to be a trained architect to appreciate good architecture or to understand it. But architects themselves are so bad at talking about their buildings.
And architects don't usually happen to be word people, which is why they're architects. They're space people and image people, which is fantastic. But that means when they open their mouth, they don't necessarily communicate very well. But the other thing is they always have to keep up appearances. They're always selling themselves. They can't really scare their clients or their potential clients. So a lot of the time they can't talk about what's really going on. And for me, what is amazing about architecture is that it is about human relationships, and quite often quite crazy human relationships. So on one level, it's this incredibly serious, important thing that is very heavy and expensive, lasts a long time, on the other hand, it's often put up by people who are not always the most well-adjusted human beings, clients, architects, politicians, and then it's inhabited by everybody else who bring their own fantasies and desires and feelings to bear on them. And the building is this kind of mineral interval between one set of emotions of the people who make it and the set of the emotions of the people who inhabit it. And of course, it's never going to be a perfect fit between all these different desires. And really, that's the nub of what's interesting to me about architecture. So a building is a proposition, really. It's an idea about how things could be in the future, and then that proposition gets tested by the people who actually use it.
Absolutely. One of my favourite things that I read just this morning was about, you say we call them buildings rather than built because they carry on living, and kind of as you've just been explaining, it's people are the missing part that keep the building alive.
Yeah, absolutely.
How have you gone, I mean, looking at the book specifically, it's split into difference of emotions and journeys and things, but very personal to you and your sort of exploration of architecture and your idea of what architecture is about. Yeah. Do you, I mean, maybe sort of describe a little bit about how the book's been put together.
Okay, well, it's got 10 books, like all great works of architecture, like going back to Vitruvius in the time of the early Roman Empire. But the 10 books are, each one relates to a different human concern or emotion. So like the idea of home, the idea of truth, money, sex, we have to have sex, of course, the idea of time, which is also life and death. So that's the structure of the book. And in each chapter, I tell stories that show how these different themes play out in particular examples, particular architects, particular times and places. It's a kind of world tour. I go to South America and Japan and
I'm so
Dubai.
Glad that you bring Lina Bobardi into the spotlight as well.
Yes. And the heroine of the book is Lina Bobardi, who in case you don't know, is a fantastic Brazilian architect who worked in Sao Paulo. She's now becoming very fashionable. Hopefully I've written the book just quick enough that I'm not accused of getting on the bandwagon. But I think she really understood how the architect has to put their feelings into a building, but they also have to leave space open for the people who come to inhabit it. It is both. You know, some people say that if buildings are about life, therefore the architect has to stand back and create an empty space for people to fill. Architects tend to think they've got to put all of themselves into the building and fill up the building with themselves. Really, it's both. You really need both. You need the architects to put their stuff in, and you need everybody else to put their stuff in, and that's when it gets interesting.
Do you think that public are becoming more savvy when it comes to architecture? Or, I mean, in Britain, for instance, I feel that the British public is sort of scared of contemporary architecture.
But I hope so. I mean, in the time that I've been writing about architecture, we have gone from, and when I started in the days when Prince Charles was rampant, and in those days, even getting people to think about a modern building as anything other than a monstrosity was difficult. So we've moved on from that. So people do appreciate new buildings, get excited. And, you know, I think something like the Shard has had a really positive reception. People are up for being excited by new buildings, but I think that there can be a kind of deepening of the understanding would be a good thing. And really, that's what I'm going to do with the book. I think too much of the discussion is at a pretty superficial level. So without getting kind of heavy and boring, I want people to discover more about what's good about buildings.
That was Rowan Moore, architecture critic and author of the brilliant book, Why We Build. Now, textile designers Mark Ely and Makako Kishimoto emerged from fashion college in the early 1990s, at a time when the London fashion scene was a hotbed of raw talent. They collaborated with the likes of Alexander McQueen and Hussein Shalayan, creating wonderful and whimsical prints that now form part of fashion history. Over the course of 20 years, the label they formed together has worked in fashion, interiors, product design and conceptual art. To reflect on two decades in the business, Ely Kishimoto presented a lecture hosted by design agency Wolf Olins as part of a series entitled Because. Monocle's Gillian de Baer sat down with them afterwards and started by asking them why.
When I was young, and I saw the definite purpose for textile design rather than abstract art. Because I know it's really coy, but I used to make my own clothes, and I could relate textile design easier than this bigger world of art.
And when you flash back 20 years and you think of your early beginnings, can you describe the fashion scene, the climate at the moment in your peers, and how you all were percolating at quite a unique time, and how those collaborations helped you start?
I think that it happens every time. It happens now. It's not significant to our time. We were just a component to some sort of creative output during the 90s, which we're still much part of the scene here now. In terms of maybe sort of leaving McQueen and having some friends which we could service on that scale, that was kind of perhaps quite unique for London in 92, 94, 95 because of the growth of the focus on Lee at that point, which we're part of the scene too. And also the journalism changed. It's like journalism changed dramatically. The media has completely changed the scene of fashion in the last 20 years since we've been through it. So we're just component and moving on with the times as we see it now, doing exactly the same thing as what we were doing at the beginning, I think.
When it comes from learning the craft, how important do you think is mentoring and apprenticeships versus learning fashion?
We have practically the studios run now by people that's come through our studio and spent 6 months with us. We have 7-8 applications a day, and we take 8 a year. We set precedence on what we expect. There's a commitment to us as much as a commitment to them. Our studio seems to generate this kind of class of people within fashion textiles who've gone on in really good places and are managing places now. There's a good ethics there, which we hope that we have and we instill with these people, and they become our friends.
I wonder if you can just explain the relationship that you have to the catwalk.
It's too straightforward. It was something which, it was an easy process to put a 12-minute show on in the way that we were doing it. And it's so repetitive and wasn't creatively challenging at all in terms of the method of getting to that stage. Whereas working with collaborators doing films in different medias, bringing to different stories through exhibitions, was much more pleasurable within the working day. So, I have a love and hate thing with it, because I know that it's required. I know that within the medium of fashion, that's the easiest platform to communicate on and to basically compete if we wanted to be. There's a commercial aspect to it as well. And also to tell stories, but I believe that the audience for our work is a little bit more intuitive to expect what we do can be a little bit more unorthodox.
I've read really when they try and summarize what you do, it's pattern the world. And I wonder if you can just describe the kind of passion you have for decorating things and surfaces.
It's just our DNA. It's like that we've done this. This is what our passion is. It's like to do repeating graphic patterns that can prolificate on any product, anywhere, anytime, and create some kind of basic surface language for people not to really get bogged down by and just hopefully think it's pretty.
But do you love it?
I love the craft of it. I love the work ethic of it. I like the idea of physically producing things ourselves under our own management. I like the friendship that it creates. I like the feedback that I get and the joy de vivre that people get from our work, which is real. It gives me much pleasure just to know that happens. So if I get feedback and I get sort of the freedom of expressing myself or ourselves in this kind of way and touch many things, then I can't think of a better job, and I want to carry on for the next 20 years doing my craft.
Congratulations to the wonderful Ely Kishimoto on 20 years at the forefront of UK fashion. Time for a bit of music. This is young London newcomer Jessie Ware with Wildest Moments. That was Jessie Ware with Wildest Moments. You're listening to Section D. Now we're off to Copenhagen, where Jan Gale, together with his firm, have transformed one of his most seminal tomes on urbanism, Life Between Buildings, into a film. We dispatched David Michon to Denmark to find out more.
Cities have grown impressively. Monumental buildings have been created. Traffic has been planned. But people's needs have often been left out.
Produced by Copenhagen's Gale Architects, Life Between Buildings is film meets installation. Shown on a 12-meter-long, 270-degree screen, the scale of it is imposing. And to be surrounded by it, you're transported to everywhere the film takes you as you explore what it means to have a city built on a human scale. For Gale, public space is critical for a city, strengthening the feeling that a city belongs to its residents. But it has to be useful, enjoyable space for it to be valuable. The film has been shown at Denmark's Louisiana Museum of Modern Art as part of their new Nordic architecture exhibition, and now again at the Venice Biennale. In this context, it's not only a manifesto on what makes for good public space, it also challenges what we consider to be part of the realm of architecture. More than individual buildings, it's what connects them and how we see and interact with them from street level. The film is for the layman, not architects. It's meant to relate to how everyday residents of a city use the space around them. Mente Marie Kalahauga is a curator at the Louisiana Museum, and I asked her why she felt the exhibition was significant.
I mean, Life Between the Buildings is important for this show because at Louisiana it's a museum of modern art, so the architecture exhibitions is not like the Danish Architecture Center, for example, where the exhibition is for professionals. We are doing exhibitions for the usual museum guests, not the experts. Therefore, we are looking at architecture in another way, where it's not the building, it's not the tectonic solutions, but more how is the building being used, and is there a requiring social life. And therefore, Jan Gehl is very important for this Nordic exhibition, because he's pointing Life Between Buildings out. I mean, the in-between spaces is architecture, as much as the architecture itself.
Helle Suholt is a founding partner at Gehl Architects and explains the tensions for Life Between Buildings.
For us, it's a matter of often being linked to small-scale interventions like pedestrian space and pedestrian issues, aspects that are very linked to a people-centered approach. But we had an urge to try and see, because I think those types of aspects are for us linked to this much more global and strategic change of direction that we need to make a decision on in cities in order to actually build more sustainable, more livable and more human environments in the future. So for us it was important to make a movie that illustrates the people-centered approach in a very global way and linked to all the global challenges of sustainability, of trash and water and social issues that so many cities around the world are facing these years.
And can you talk a little bit about the format of the film? Because it's not just on a regular screen, it's on a curved screen that kind of spans 270 degrees. Why was it chosen to show the film on a screen that's non-standard?
Right. The exhibition was done, or the film was done for an exhibition where our part of the film was to illustrate how public space is part of a way of designing your society. So essentially we wanted to see whether we could design a public space. So the film is designed as a circle, as an agora that you can actually step into, walk into, and you can feel surrounded of this whole story and approach.
It's going to be shown at the Venice Biennale. How do you think it sits next to those more traditional understandings of architecture? Is urban planning often forgotten as part of that context?
I do think it is showing the value of everyday aesthetics, of everyday life. I think sometimes we forget those issues, all the things that are important for us as people, the fact that we can meet, the fact that we can talk here, the memory I had of meeting my fiancé on that corner and so forth. And we forget about these memories and the way people live in cities. And when we talk about architecture, it's much more about form and aesthetics. So what we are trying to illustrate is a different approach where hopefully these two things can be merged.
Copenhagen is the film's prime example, and many cities around the world look to the Danish capital to inspire their own public spaces. But the new Nordic exhibition rightfully asks whether the success of Copenhagen has something to do with the Nordic way of life, a region that has a long history of public space and holds social welfare in high esteem. Kalle Hauge is skeptical the concept is easy to export.
I don't think you can export the whole idea about this because Copenhagen and Denmark, the cities and urban planning are very much influenced by the welfare state, or the idea of the welfare state, also called the Nordic model, which influences the public spaces and the public buildings. Everything is public in this city, almost. And I think this idea is very visible also in the way we are moving in the city and the way the city is built up.
Life Between Buildings runs at the Biennale until November 25th. For Monocle, I'm David Michon.
And from healthy cities to healthy houses, Paul Folleros is director of Australian firm Health Habitat. It's a company devoted to improving the health and living environment of disadvantaged people through good design. Adrian Craddock met up with him in London this week to hear more.
The way our work started and what we still do today is we start work on existing houses where people are living, and we go through and check them very, very carefully. We check about 250 things in every house. While we're checking them, we have the resources at hand to start fixing those houses on the very first day of a project. And we fix things that really relate to people's health and well-being, and middle class or wealthier people often take for granted all the most basic things that you need in a house to improve your health. Running water, shower, working, place to cook a meal, remove waste out of the building safely. I mean, most people take that for granted in developed countries. And a lot of the work we do is in either poorer parts of developed countries, and in the last 6 years in less developed or developing countries. So the same sort of work.
Sure. You work very closely with a doctor and a public health worker. How does that relationship kind of play out throughout the work?
It's a good question. We were thrown together 27 years ago, a doctor and a public and environmental health guy. I'm the odd one out of the three directors. I'm the architect, so I'm actually in the minority. So the focus of our work is health. And I think what it's really done, as an architect, we tend to think of buildings, buildings and buildings, whereas these guys, working with them closely over a long period of time, has really instructed me in the point that buildings need to do something, and the thing they can do is actually improve people's lives quite dramatically, which is, we think of that often in terms of buildings look good or they function well, but we rarely think about it in terms of actually improving people's quality of life at a most basic level. Like a child 0 to 5 who lives in a house that works will have a massively better chance of all things in life, not just long life, but they'll have a better chance of performing at school well, they'll have a better chance of getting a job, because they'll be in much better health from the age of 5 on. And that's pretty profound.
And many countries have used the model that you've helped pioneer to kind of apply it to more disadvantaged communities in their areas. I believe Nepal, is that right? What kind of work are you doing over there?
Well, the principles are the same, but often the solutions obviously look different and should be different because we're in a totally different culture, different place. So in Nepal, for example, a small village contacted Health Habitat with the problem they had no toilets for a population of 450 people. These were one of the poor, low-caste villages who are used to getting not a lot. So Health Habitat went over and worked with the village, and I stress that, we worked with people, and the people had to put in significant money and a lot of effort. But we designed and built, we've now finished the first village, we built 58 toilets, the 400 people now have toilets. But there, we also noticed a problem that people couldn't afford cooking gas, so they were chopping green trees, young trees, and the poorest people live on the steepest land. So that after they cut too many trees, two things happened. The land slipped, they had major erosion problems, and they lost the only real wealth they had, which was land. The other thing, they were cooking on green timber inside enclosed houses, which meant the levels of smoke that kids and women had to put up with was very high, and the leading cause of death was respiratory failure, lungs packing up because of this smoke. So we decided that we used the human waste and the animal waste, because people often will keep a buffalo or a cow, we combine the waste and we put that into a biogas digester, so people get 3 to 4 hours free, clean cooking fuel every day from the human waste. So we try, like, good design should solve a number of problems, not So we don't just provide toilets, we provide toilets that dispose of the waste, but we also then reuse the waste to give people some other benefit to improve nutrition in this case, so they get a better chance of cooking a meal.
It may sound like a flippant question almost, but does aesthetic play into your work at all? I mean, do you kind of use form in kind of an interesting way while you're doing these projects as well?
Simple answer is no. but again, I think, I mean, someone said to me recently, you know, do you worry about beauty in the work you do? And I think that's actually not such a flippant question. And I think my answer is yes. I think the beauty is really important. But I think to see a family in Nepal cooking off a single burner that is producing no smoke gives them a much better quality of life. Their lungs improve noticeably in the first few months of this system being installed. To see the kids without weeping eyes, I would argue that's a great definition of beauty. To see Indigenous people in Australia able to see their kids healthier, not having basically to go to hospital as many times as they were used to them going, to me is a thing of great beauty, and it really depends how you define beauty.
So last year you won the UN World Habitat Day Award. Can you explain what that award is and what it meant for Health Habitat to win that?
It's an international award. It's UN Habitat support it, and as do the Building and Social Housing Foundation of Britain, UK. They also contribute to both the prize and then disseminating, I think is the right word, the knowledge of the winners. And we were lucky to win. There was 250 finalists from 82 countries around the world. So it certainly touches on most of the world, many, many countries. It's not just for the four or five wealthy countries. We were surprised, I think, partly because we do come, most of our work's been done in a developed country, and to win this award often is work that comes from developing countries. So the judges came and looked at the work, so I think we were more than happy to win it. The most important bit of the award has been, the reason I'm in London, it was actually yesterday talking to people from around the UK about the principles in the work we've used to improve housing and health, and to hear what's being done in the UK with very similar problems for public housing and some of the poorer housing areas in the UK. I learnt a lot yesterday from what's being done in the UK, and I hope people took maybe a few of the lessons that we from the work we've been doing in Australia. So it's the year's been spent taking the work to many parts of the world, and just to not to say you should be doing the same work we do in Australia, but to look at the principles and say some of these principles may be able to help you do some things in your country.
You talk about it almost as if there's kind of a taboo on this subject, I mean, within the architecture world. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, look, I think that's true. And I also think it's a fault sometimes of people preaching the sort of work as being the worthiness of doing this work. And I stay right away from that. I don't think it's any more worthy than working for a wealthy client in the middle of London. You know, I think good work is good work. And I stress that one of the reasons I think I'm most involved in this is that I think it gives us a chance to do really good design work. And that's something that I think a lot of professionals don't really get, a lot of architects don't get. They think it's somehow lesser work, whereas I would argue it's actually as complex, if not more complex, than doing high-rise buildings or complex buildings. You're dealing with social issues, you're dealing with an extreme lack of resources, and you're dealing with how to use every millimetre, every cent to maximum advantage. And also the work is tested by medical test, by actually health assessment, not by taking photos of it. And that's the toughest test of all. It's something I've learnt, that to have 5 years of work assessed by a medical team, not by taking pictures and talking to the client about whether they like the work or not, but actually to see if health has improved, is a really tough test on the work we do. So it's forced me to, I think, grow up as a professional. You actually have to realise that it's to achieve success is much tougher than winning a couple of awards and taking some nice photos.
I mean, talking about growing up, I imagine that you must be working in some pretty confronting circumstances at times. Is it hard to detach yourself from that, you know, just as an architect?
That's a really good question. I don't think anyone's ever asked that. And in fact, it's a very real issue. We employ about 30 managers around Australia in the Australian work to do this work. And one thing we had to do a number of years ago now, that we actually have a psychologist and we refer people to a psychologist to actually almost debrief them And we've found that there was a crack-up rate amongst people who were entering these worlds. And the psychologist compares it to battle fatigue. And they say that people are confronted by situations that are so desperately difficult that after a while they find it hard to return. So we treat it very seriously. It is a serious issue, and people often haven't experienced the levels of poverty that we see in these projects.
As I say, you're off to the Venice Biennale soon. Am I right in saying that you're doing a little bit of consulting work while you're over there? I read that you're actually consulting some Venetians while you're over there as well.
We have spent probably more time and effort on that part of the project than anything else. We have to go through layers of local government, community government, which is absolutely right. We should have to do all of that. It's just our way of working that we never go to any place and talk. We usually try and fix something before we start talking. So I couldn't see why we'd do any differently in Venice. So we're trying to get just a couple of houses. We've got some money allocated to improve those houses for a couple of families. It's not going to change Italy or Venice, but it keeps us, I guess, it keeps us honest, and it keeps us thinking about the nature of the work is actually to make improvement, not to talk about it, not just have exhibitions, but Health Habitat's had very little in the way of exhibitions. This is not our normal venue. Venice is not the sort of thing normally we would be doing. But at this point, we think it is important. It is important to take this work to other parts of the world, so it's reasonable. But at the same time, we want to try and do just a little bit of fix work if we're there. And I'll tell you in a few days' time whether we managed to pull it off, but it seems like a bureaucratic hurdle. But as of last night, we're looking slightly more positive, so I hope we'll achieve something.
That was Adrian Craddock with Paul Folleros, Director of Health Habitat there. We'll be talking toilets in Portugal after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. Now, a Portuguese toilet paper brand known for its black and coloured loo rolls has launched what it calls the sexiest WC on earth in the centre of Lisbon. It's complete with jazzy music, perfumed spaces, and even an art exhibition. Our correspondent, Saima Tariq, took a tour of the public bathroom with Renova's CEO to see if it lives up to the hype.
For our brand, for Renova, that is a paper toilet brand and a napkins brand, we pretend to have the sexiest product, the sexiest paper on earth, and here we have the sexiest WC on earth.
Started in 1818, Renova has long been a household name in Portugal. But 10 years ago, a major relaunch, combined with an ad campaign focusing on sex appeal, has made it one of the most well-known brands in its industry worldwide. Its attempt to turn an ordinary household item into an icon has been successful, at least financially. Now, its new public bathroom has given the brand a space in the Portuguese capital to show off its product range. CEO Paulo Silveira da Silva takes me on a tour.
We are a very serious brand with very good products. We try to have very good products and to have lots of fiction in the same products. We are doing toilet paper, but it's not an awful product or a product that we don't speak about because it's not a noble product. We try to change that. So here in this space, we try to change also the space where the paper is used and to create something new. So, without discrimination, with the art. Now, in this moment, we have an exhibition of a Portuguese photographer, Francisco Gomes. It's the result of an artist residence in Renova. So he has done all these photos you have here in the book that we just launched, that you have here also. If you want to wash your hands, this is an installation. You have the small cabins that are all in wood with more than, 10,000 pieces of wood. And you can rest inside and take your time. And you have lots of space. We have a small shop with our products, our sexiest products, the colors, and also some vintage products. The first toilet paper in Portugal, super.
So it's 50 cents to use?
50 cents, yes. So when you come in, you can choose in more than 300 toilet halls, 300 kinds of toilet halls. If you choose one hall, we have to pay a little bit more if you want one hall only for you. If not, you have the normal toilet paper inside. Close, just to have an idea about you can rest, and if you are in a busy day or in Lisbon, you can rest when you come inside. You have lots of place to put things, no problem. Every cabin is cleaned after each utilization. I like it very much, the wood.
Who designed it?
Is Miguel Vieira Batista, is a Portuguese designer that has done this project for us.
The work of photographer Francisco Gomez greets visitors in the main entrance to the WC. He tells me more about his work at Renova's factory in Torres Novas.
They invited me to photograph some spaces of Renova. It was an art residency project, and I've been there for during 1 year, and I've been searching for lost spaces with some old histories inside the factory. So all the book is about these lost spaces with a lot of stories, and it's kind of a hidden places inside the history of the factory. You also can find some textures and paper textures and colors inside the book.
Renova's greatest marketing move, and one which firmly put itself on the paper goods map, was in 2005, when it launched its black toilet paper, today sold in 50 international markets.
It was a product, an iconic product from Renova that has been spoken all over the world. And after we tried to have different colors, different products, we changed the colors. The last color is brown for toilet paper. But everybody is buying it, perhaps not for every day, I don't know, but it's for everybody. Every color, you can match it with the colors of the toilet, of, I don't know, whatever you want in your, and it's not something so expensive. When we launched the black toilet paper, and people are saying, why black toilet paper? And my answer was always, why not? So in our company, we have a very big wall when we wrote, why not? So if you ask me, can the toilet paper be sexy? Why not?
With plans to open another sexy WC in New York, Renova believes its toilet paper concept will continue to grow. And, Paolo hopes, put more bums on seats. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Saima Tarek.
I'm not so sure the words sexy and toilet should go together, but there we go. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of Section D. We're off to Venice for the Architecture Biennale, and next week we'll be bringing you all the highlights, so be sure to tune in then. Today's show was edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. And playing you out, here's a beautiful bit of Swedish bossa nova, Desafinado, which means off-key, by Lovisa. Goodbye.
Love is like a never-ending melody. Always have compared it to a symphony. A symphony conducted by the lighting of